Fellow seminarians, it's good to be with you today. You know, the other day I was reading a book by one of the most eminent biologists and geneticists ever. His name is Dr. Ernst Mayr. He had a career that spanned all the way from the 1920s until the writing of his final book in 2000, I believe it was four. Can you imagine? 80 years of work in the field and research. And you know, in his book, What is Evolution? How he ended it? He says, in his estimation of Christian ethics and where it came from, he said, Christian ethics is a powerful tool, but we very seldom ever use it. This is from a man who had just been speaking about where humans evolved from, talking about the fact that humans evolved because they ran into a situation where the savanna in Africa had run out of trees and they had no more defense. How do you get from evolution to the idea that Christian ethics is where we need to go? Well, it tells me that there are a lot of questions still in the scientific community and that we need to step forward as Christians and continue to preach about and live about what we say we believe about God and science and its relationship. And it's been my privilege, as Dr. North was talking, to be able to work with a number of scientific institutions and religious institutions that are seeking to understand better how the world works together. And the Gloria Patri, we just returned from Italy just a few weeks ago, where we had our second annual conference. It was wonderful. We were up in the Alps. We had 53 people from approximately 10 different academic disciplines. And though the most of us were Seventh-day Adventists, we had a number of other denominations who were present as well. People want to know what Seventh-day Adventists think about religion, and I'm getting a lot of opportunity to talk about that. And so, what we have is important, and where we go in life is important. And my talk today is going to center on the idea of perspective. And for some reason, the most important part of my title got left out of the bulletin. It's actually not just Einstein and me. It's Einstein and me. It's all about perspective. Nigel Calder provides a most charming illustration of Einstein's theory of relativity in the following passage. The idea that time stands still at the edge of a black hole has to be taken quite literally. A black hole could be used to stretch a person's life and let him survive for thousands of years into the future. The would-be time traveler, in my opinion, should be discouraged from diving into the black hole. Despite optimistic speculations about hopping through a black hole to another region of space and time, or even into another universe, it seems improbable, to put it mildly, that the diver would avoid destruction. No, what he should do is to take his spaceship into orbit around a black hole as closely as he dares, in a time shell where his clocks, atomic and biological, run very slowly, as judged by a distant onlooker. In practice, the tidal stresses would be formidably great, unless the black hole were a very large one, and he would, in any case, have to keep his motor running to avoid being driven in. The nearest stable orbit where an unpowered spaceship could survive lies at 6 times the radius of a non-rotating black hole. There, the slowing of time is only a few months per year. But let us imagine that against all odds, the time traveler succeeds in skimming around and around the black hole, so close to the surface that he is in a time shell, where clocks run at 1,000th of their rate at the Earth's surface. The signals coming from the Earth to the spaceship circling close around the black hole will appear to be running fast. In the jargon, they will show an enormous gravitational blue shift, and the radio frequency of the transmissions will appear in a completely different high-frequency band in the receiver. To understand them, the astronaut will have to record them and play them back in a much slowed form. But the information they will be carrying will arrive fast and thick, too. The time traveler will receive a daily news bulletin from the Earth every 90 seconds. And, oh, wonder of wonders, he will witness a U.S. presidential election 5 times a week. Wow. If his friends transmit their heartbeats to the time traveler, he will hear them as a high-pitched hum. Going the other way, the time traveler's signals will be registered on the Earth with an enormous gravitational redshift. His friends at base will have to tune their receivers to a low-frequency band and be prepared to record and speed up the messages to make them intelligible. But they will not have to work very hard at it. The time traveler's daily reports will come in once every 3 years. And a 10-minute greeting will take a week to record. As the time traveler's heartbeat, that will come to Earth about once every 20 minutes. If he sends them a television picture of himself, one blink of his eye will seem similarly protected in time. Yet, back in his spaceship, going around and around the black hole, the time traveler is not aware of any peculiarity about time within his own surroundings. If he feels his pulse, his heart is beating normally, physically, biologically, and psychologically. But there is also a complete consistency in the discrepancy in time between the two camps. Within a few weeks, the time traveler will receive news that all his friends are dead. If he continues to circle the black hole for 10 years and then flies back to the Earth, he will find 10,000 years have passed into a period when his own era writes only a few lines in the archaeological textbooks. But he will never be able to return to his former time. In relativity theory, there is no method for any real object or individual or information to travel backwards in time. High-speed travel, too, can keep you young. Our astronaut does not need to find a black hole in order to engage in time travel and so outlive his colleagues on Earth. In empty space, he can plan a flight in such a way as to make the atomic clocks in his spaceship and his body run, on the average, slower than the clocks at home. The plan turns out to be really quite simple. All he has to do is go off at a high speed in any direction, then turn around and come home again. The faster he goes and the longer he travels, the greater his advantage in time will be. So says Nigel Calder. It is said that there are those serendipitous moments in life when a person hears or sees or experiences something that points the way forward for him or for her from that moment on. The first time I read those words of Nigel Calder, I received a vision of how truly wonderful science is. I was a teenager in a bookstore in Sherman, Texas, taking a brief rest during a music tour of some sort that I was on. And as I breathlessly read those words, I could not wait to read more, to learn more. Those words gave me the direction I would move toward in life, a roadmap. Einstein had managed to keep the child within the man. To ask the questions that only children care to know the answer to, he once noted. To read Calder's illustration of Einsteinian relativity was like reading the real-life version of Buck Rogers. It was like seeing the Jetsons in vivid color. It was the most wonderful dream, and it sparkled and beckoned with great promise. Until I went to university. And then this marvelous dream began to fizzle and fade. I went to pre-calculus with great anticipation, only to discover that nobody including the professor, cared a fiddle-faddle about time travel or Einstein or black holes, even though Einstein's ideas seemed to center around the most intriguing mathematical equations I had ever seen. The professor would stand, his back to the class, mumbling on about nonsense such as A squared plus B squared equals C squared. All right, it wasn't complete nonsense, but it certainly didn't have wings and fly. It may have been necessary to know equations like that, but where was the context, the excitement, the possibility for imagination? Why did Pythagoras care about such things anyway? Oh well, I thought, it'll get better. So off I went to biology. This is a weeder class for pre-meds, we were quickly apprised. And so the learning of bones and systems and bodily functions became a necessary chore. The delight of discovering the complexity of the human form was always underwritten with a certain kind of terror that if I didn't do well, then I would become one of them. Them that can become doctors and them that can't teach. Oh well, I thought, there's still physics. And so I went to physics, the realm of Einstein and other really cool people. I could hardly wait to work that very first important problem that would eventually carry me to the realms hitherto unimagined. So with great anticipation, I breathlessly turned the pages and hurried straight to the first problem, which read, calculate the velocity of a flea at the top of its jump. I was positively stunned. Fleas? Who wants to contemplate fleas? My mother, coming from that very proper American European culture of the state of Iowa, who scrubbed everything daily, hourly, moment by moment, and who insisted that Teddy, our beloved Sheltie, remain forever banned from the comfortable life of indoor living, had taught me to look upon fleas with great derision. Could there possibly have been a dumber question in the world than to consider fleas? To be perfectly honest, I really tried to recapture the delight of those few printed pages in Nigel Calder's book. I tried to hang on to the charm, the delight, the almost naivety of it all. But it was all so boring and mechanical and full of balls rolling around, and I began to lose interest. I finally decided to do something different. I became a theologian. And it was here that I encountered a certain statement of Jesus. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Something delightfully playful underlies those words. Something Einsteinian. Unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And just as with Einstein, the man, the woman, is called forth to something that is mature, deliberate, and momentous. No matter how charming or naive that something appears to be in its initial instance. For being childlike means having faith that while accidents may occur from time to time, in general, the fundamental constants will not ultimately fail. That the sun will go on shining even in the face of tragedy. That the rain will fall on the good and on the bad alike. This element within Einsteinian relativity, the concept that perspective belongs to the observer, is crucial. How one sees the world is necessarily tempered by one's experience of the world. This is an area where faith and science often clash. It would seem improbable, impossible, for the universe to work as Calder describes it. And though some of the details about that working have changed and been updated in the years since he first penned those lines, the fact remains that Einstein's theory of relativity has become a stabilizing force in the scientific understanding of the world. It has literally opened the doors to realms that were once even beyond imagination. Einstein's faith that there even was such a door was due by his own admission to his childlike wonder about the world. The Christian faith proposes something similar. As I have studied Christian thought across the span of its existence, I have found this same childlike faith stretching from the apostles to the early church fathers, such as Clement of Alexandria, to the angelic Dr. Thomas, to Luther and Barth and beyond. But often, when we look at these great men of faith, we see them only as words on a page, and not as the real people who they were, people who struggled with the everyday details of life. One man who left behind the record of his struggles was the founding father of scholastic thought, Boethius. In a sense, according to the neo-Thomistic scholar Joseph Pieper, the dividing line between the ancient Christianity of Rome and Greece and the dawn of the Middle Ages was nothing less than a transition between two world powers. As the new Germanic powers rose to ascendancy, Pieper notes, there were those among them who sought to preserve both the pagan and Christian writings of the ancients. The first of a new line of scholastics, Boethius laid the foundation for this transition between pre-medieval and medieval philosophy. He sought to preserve through translation the most important writings that would not only serve as a bridge between the ancient and medieval worlds, but would also provide a launching pad for a new methodology. Basing his course on the action of the notion of wherever possible to join faith with reason. His series of tractates would become the foundation upon which Thomas Aquinas would base his own writings. And yet, as Boethius languished in prison, awaiting his execution by the Gothic king Theodoric, who had accused him of treason, his last words to the world were hedged in by doubt. In the Consolation of Philosophy, Boethius, struggling to find confidence in his journey between reason and faith, first raises the questions, if God exists, whence comes evil? If he does not exist, whence comes good? Is it true that evil, in reality, possesses no being? If divine providence dominates history, what about human freedom? Pieper brings an interesting observation to bear in his analysis of Boethius. First, he proposes that what Boethius was struggling to say in the last moments of his life was that whatever we have becomes our own only if we transform it into ourselves in the innermost chambers of our being. In the final reckoning, what a person is, not what he has, counts. Not every thought we are able to conceive and not every concept that is part of our stock of knowledge really belongs to us as our own property. No matter how strongly it may appeal to reflective reason, and no matter how forthrightly we express our formal agreement with it, a man can very well write, as Boethius did, a highly ingenious book on the Trinity, and yet it may come to light when life or death is the issue, that he is unable to harvest any fruit, unable to derive any consolation from such knowledge. No one can anticipate the final testing, and it alone can reveal to us what really belongs to us and what does not. The extreme situation in which a man or a woman is left with only his or her true possessions has laws of its own. Pieper goes on to muse, would it not be possible, I ask myself, for this Athens-educated Roman Boethius to have been a sincere Christian at heart, and yet in that extreme situation to have found himself shudderingly cast back upon an interpretation of life in which the profound consolation of the Christian mystery remained mute? In no epoch, no matter how Christian it may have been, have faith and hope been so readily available to humanity that it only has had to reach out for them. That is an inexorable fact. It may be forgotten, but it cannot be altered. However much we are on a familiar footing with the divine mystery in our speech and thought, the ability to choose one's perspective, to create one's own take on the world, is a crucial part of being human. James Kekelios, in his book, The Physics of Superheroes, makes an interesting observation about the nature of free will, of which the role of perspective is crucial. He points to the experiment of a ball being tossed in an arc, noticing that there are many questions we may ask concerning the nature of the ball and its journey through space and time, such as, how high does the ball travel? How far to the right does it move? How long is it in the air? How fast is it going? What is the geometric shape of its path? However, Kekulius notes, I would argue that there is one simple question that implies all of the above questions and gets at the heart of the issues concerning the ball's motion. That one single question is the following. Does the ball have any choice? If the ball does not have any choice in its motion, if it lacks free will, then its trajectory is completely determined by forces external to itself. Once we determine the nature of these forces and how they influence the ball's motion, we may then calculate the path of the ball for a given initial velocity imparted by the thrower. If we then repeat the toss with exactly the same initial position and velocity as before, then the ball must exactly and faithfully trace out the calculated trajectory, for the ball does not have any choice in the matter. The question that we must here ponder is this: in what way, if any, are we like the ball that is tossed in an arc? What are the forces that impress themselves upon us? The powerful leader of ancient Israel, Joshua, once commanded his people to choose this day whom you will serve, whether it be the gods of the natural forces or the God of heaven who created the forces of nature. This view contrasts sharply against the materialistic viewpoint about the natural world that tell us that we are not masters of our own destiny, that we possess no choice about how we interact with the world, that we are but so much jetsam and flotsam cast by some mysterious forces upon the tidal wave of time. But the scriptures remind us that we can and do choose our perspective of the world, and that as seemingly all-pervasive as the forces of nature may appear to be, there is still one who presides over their ultimate course. I am personally glad that people like Einstein and Boethius left the legacy not only of their faith in the reliability of the physical constants and their belief in God for us to contemplate, but I am even more grateful that they also left a record of their struggles, for it gives us hope that we too can find courage to sally forth. Einstein maintained a steady belief in his presuppositions about the world, waiting patiently for that day when his views would pass from tentative hypothesis to theory. And Pieper assures us that in the end, Boethius found peace and an affirmation of faith. I too found a reaffirmation of faith in scientific exploration and my turn to the study of God. I found in the scriptures that God delights in the world, that he is interested in even the tiniest of details. Jesus, who often pointed to nature to illustrate his discussions about God, once noted that faith is like a mustard seed. He proposed that God is the fundamental constant in the universe and illustrated this point by noting that just as God knows when sparrows fall, he also knows when humans struggle, and that just as the shepherd knows his sheep and searches for them when they are lost, so he too comes in search of a lost and struggling humanity. Thus, it is a necessary fact of life that if we are to move forward in science or in seeking after God, that we must choose our perspective and we must embrace the possibilities of that perspective, believing by faith that there are doors that open into other realms, It is in keeping a childlike trust and wonder that the doors of heaven and the heavens open before our astonished eyes.